This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Philip Hamburger. He is the Maurice and Hilda Friedman Professor of Law at Columbia Law School. I spoke with him on May 28, 2003. Download the MP3 of our produced show with Philip Hamburger at onbeing.org. Well, I would like to start, and I think we should just start talking and let these engineers work it out as we go along. Are we okay, Mitch? Can we?
Well, please continue to talk.
All right. I would like to start, and I do this with everyone, whatever the subject is, to get a little sense, if you'd give me one of your own religious vantage point or background. This won't be on tape, but I think is an important place to start. And, you know, but by way of getting at how you got into this and what your interest was coming in.
Can I ask you a favor?
Yes.
It's the only request I'll have as to what we talk about or not talk about, which is that I quite assiduously keep my own religious views out of my scholarship.
Okay.
And so it's something I just don't talk about.
Okay.
And it's not that the views are particularly unusual. It's just that because so many people have a non-objective approach to scholarship, I try to just show that one could take a slightly different approach.
Okay.
I know that you have different, very good reasons for doing this.
Mm-hmm.
But I try not to bring a religious approach to this, but I'm happy to talk about how I got into this.
Yeah. Well, tell me then why you cared about this and how you got into the project. Yeah. I mean, some passion or some interest.
Yes. I'm very much interested in law and particularly the rule of law. And to that end, have often studied history. And I got into this utterly by accident. It was really the last thing I planned to do. I had many other projects I wanted to pursue. One afternoon, I was just skimming through some 18th century sermons, which are a wonderful source of knowledge about 18th century culture and politics. And I kept on coming across some strange references to separation of religion and government, or separation sometimes of church and state. And that struck me as rather odd. And what was particularly strange was that these sermons were not advocating separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm.
They were actually accusing others of holding this pernicious view. And what struck me as all the more strange, of course, was that the folks who were being accused of holding this view, religious dissenters, minorities, I happen to know from my other work, never advocated separation of church and state or separation of religion and government. So I thought this might make a curious 5-page essay in a theological magazine. At any rate, 500 pages later, I had blown away several years of my life pursuing a topic I'd never really planned to look at.
Right. And I mean, that is an interesting place to start, that this phrase initially was coined as really sort of a caricature.
Quite. Mm-hmm. It was a way with which establishment ministers made fun of or tried to slander minority ministers who were seeking religious liberty. They were told by the establishment ministers, you don't really want religious liberty. What you're really seeking is to separate church and state, i.e. to separate government from the foundations of morality. And of course, the dissenters hardly appreciated that.
Right. I mean, also the point is that the dissenters considered that to be a slam against which they wanted to defend themselves, which is the other interesting half of that.
Yes. and in fact, although I very much admire the religious dissenters at the time, they were in a very awkward spot because they did want some disconnection from government, but not generally put. They wanted simply to have none of the illicit or the adulterous connections between church and state. They wanted simply not to have an establishment of religion. So they had a difficult time responding to this accusation.
Right. And I mean, I think one thing that is first, just in the beginning of reading your work, what is striking is that it was deeply religious people considering this and reflecting on it from many sides in deeply religious ways. And you know, this focus, as you've just alluded to, on purity. I mean, it was because they wanted to be more religious or more purely religious.
Yes, it's rather odd. What I thought would be turned into a study of religious liberty then began to become a study of how, in some ways, religious passions become transposed to other objects. And some people seek purity through the religion, others by purifying themselves from religion, or at least from religious organizations, not least, of course, the Catholic Church, which was viewed with a faint sense of horror, I think, by many earlier Americans.
And that's a fascinating part of the story, too, which we'll get to, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, and some of, but just some of the religious language that you found that was being used. And, you know, you have this, you said, wrote, the wall separating church and state. And here we're talking about sort of the mm-hmm. stretch of time, late 16th to late 18th century. The wall separating church and state was built upon the remains of an earlier wall which separated the garden from the wilderness.
Yes. The medieval convents, for example, were separated by a wall from the outside world. And that sort of language of separation, of purity, trying to keep all that's unregenerate, all that's impure away from one's religious experience, becomes in an odd way the model for the standard of religious liberty known as separation of church and state. And it's peculiar, isn't it, that
yeah.
a religious metaphor, a metaphor coming out of the Catholic Church and then adopted by Calvinists as a symbol of their being among the elect, then becomes the standard of secular religious liberty. It's a rather ironic twist.
And yeah, and talk about, let's say, the thought of Calvin. I mean, Calvin and Luther, you both delve into. But, mm-hmm. you know, again, you know, you make this point repeatedly. The conclusions we draw from some language are not necessarily the conclusions that they were drawing. And so, on the one hand, Calvin could talk mm-hmm. about two separate spheres of spiritual polity and civil polity. But talk about how he really still saw those two spheres as interacting with each other.
Yeah, many early Christians and then many leaders of the Reformation do treat church and state as distinct. And in that sense, it's very easy to look back and assume that they were talking about a separation of church and state. But while they thought that these two different spheres of life and two different institutions might be distinct, that hardly meant for them that they were to be kept apart. So Calvin, just to take one example, anticipates very close relationships between church leaders and leaders of the state. The church should instruct the people and the leaders of the people, the civil leaders, as to how to live righteous lives uh-huh. and to conduct the nation in a righteous way. And by the same token, the state has a role, for example, in educating the people in Christianity. And so there's actually a very intimate relationship between the two. Even by the 18th century, rather ironically, becomes the case that the leading argument for an establishment of religion is precisely that church and state are distinct institutions. William Warburton, an Anglican bishop, points out that because church and state are distinct, they in fact have to be allied. And so the difference between these two institutions actually becomes the leading argument for an establishment or alliance between church and state, far from being a separation of the two.
Right. So more sort of parity, right?
Yeah. He seemed to think that they would be dependent upon one another for self-preservation. Mm. And so they had to form a sort of treaty or alliance by which each supported the other.
Right.
And that sort of distinction between church and state hardly seems compatible with separating the two, does it?
No. Well, not the way we've come to understand it. So, you know, what I'd like to do is dip into this story that you tell a bit and then
okay.
get to what it all means and, you know, what you've been thinking about in terms of what happens now. But I do want to... The story is fascinating, and I think telling the story and getting it out there is a good foundation. So then, yeah, and you know, somebody else, you know, you talk about Roger, you gave me a completely new picture of Roger Williams, for example, among mm-hmm. those founding personalities we think of. I mean, as a very intolerant person.
Yeah, Roger Williams has been turned into an apostle of religious liberty. And certainly he did argue for a sort of religious liberty. On the other hand, he does not seem to have argued for a separation of church and state, but rather a separation between the garden and the wilderness, between the regenerate and the unregenerate. He arrives in America and is a separatist, believing that not only does one have to worship separately from not only does one have to worship in voluntarily organized congregations separate from the parishes of England, but even that it's a sin to worship when visiting England with Anglicans in their own churches. And because his fellow Congregationalists in America are willing to go back to England and worship with Anglicans, he wishes to separate himself still further and hence is known as a separatist. And he took his separatism so far, of course, that he eventually is thrown out of Massachusetts in a fit of intolerance by the leaders of that colony. But he had his own form of intolerance because he sought a purity so intense that in the end he was unwilling to worship for very long with almost anybody. For a brief moment, he becomes a Baptist, but that lasts only a few months when he decides that his fellow Baptists aren't pure enough for him. And some accuse him of being so concerned about his purity that he won't even worship with his wife. Although whether that's true is not altogether clear.
I mean, I went to Brown. Is that the Baptist church? That's the Baptist church right there in Providence, right? That he
supposedly
founded, but then you point out he left just a couple of months after.
The Baptists like to think of him as a Baptist. And for, as I said, for a few months at least, he was a Baptist. Mm-hmm. But in the end, he declares himself a seeker, i.e. one who's wandering in search of a communion he can stay with, which consists, I think, in the end, largely of just himself and perhaps God. We're in no position to judge that.
All right. And then there's Thomas Jefferson.
Yes. Thomas Jefferson is often viewed as the father of separation of church and state in this country because, of course, he wrote a letter to the Baptists in 1802 in which he talks about the First Amendment in terms of separation of church and state. The Baptists in Connecticut had been seeking to get rid of their state's establishment of religion and were not having a very successful time of it. So they write a letter, the Danbury Baptist Association writes a letter to Thomas Jefferson asking for his political support. And they record this in their minutes and they await an answer. And when he wrote back, instead of simply saying that he supported their attempt to get rid of an establishment of religion, he talks about separation of church and state. Now, most people, when thinking about Thomas Jefferson, actually wonder why did he write this and what does it mean, which I think are very reasonable inquiries. But what I think is a good starting point is to think about what the Baptists did when they got his letter. And far from celebrating it, rather than publishing it in the newspapers and hoping to use it in their political campaign against an establishment, they become very silent. And they don't even record it in their minute book.
Which is fascinating because, as you said, they recorded the fact that they had made this decision to write to him. And
yes,
you
and
would think that
it
would be worth recording that a president wrote you back.
Quite. And other Baptist organizations, when they get letters from the president, do publish these letters in their minutes and in newspapers and celebrate the fact. And the Danbury Baptists are profoundly embarrassed because, of course, in Connecticut, which is a very traditional state at this time, separation of church and state remains an accusation. It's something to be abhorred. And so they're quite embarrassed, and they're probably worried that it will do them political damage.
And let's suggest, be clear, this is the letter in which he coins the phrase, the wall of separation.
Yes, although I think he draws this language from an earlier establishment minister, Richard Hooker, who again had used it as an accusation in the 1590s against dissenters. But Jefferson has such a tin ear that he doesn't really see that and instead elevates it as a standard of religious liberty. Now, why did he do this? It's probably for political reasons rather than to help the Baptists. The phrase separation of church and state or separation of religion and politics becomes popular in America in 1800 during the election of Thomas Jefferson. His opponents had accused him of being an infidel and an atheist. In fact, I think more accurately, he was a deist heading towards Unitarianism, but that didn't matter politically. And his friends decide to defend him by telling his critics, who are mostly clerics, Congregationalist ministers, by telling them that they should keep politics and religion separate. In other words, they should not exercise their freedom of speech in criticizing Thomas Jefferson. And so when he writes to the Baptists, he's picking up a campaign slogan which has been used to silence his critics.
And these days we would hold such this kind of evidence in that context with some suspicion, I believe.
It's not the normal way, I hope it's not the normal way in which constitutional standards come to be adopted. Mm-hmm. But that's a large part of the story. Oddly enough, it's through a popular slogan and, in fact, through rather prejudiced politics that this phrase becomes a constitutional principle.
Okay. And there, in that part of the story, and now we're moving into the 19th century, right?
Mm-hmm.
You remind us, and Americans have such a short historical memory, of things we don't want to remember in our history, anti-Catholicism, which it's almost impossible to imagine to the degree that this existed. I mean, that in the 1830s, Catholic churches were burned down by Protestants.
Yeah, it is odd. It was a complete surprise to me, and I must say that this history has quite changed my view of the development of American law. Mm. I tended to think of it as a general trend towards progress. I now have some doubts. Yes, in the 1840s, when large numbers of Catholics, particularly Irish Catholics, come to this country, they encounter a fair degree of prejudice from Protestants, not all Protestants, but certainly many. And in some cities, the Protestants organize into fraternal organizations, nativist organizations, in the sense that they viewed themselves as being native-born, unlike the foreign-born Catholics. And the nativists at times became so intense in their animosities that they end up burning down churches, and in some cities going so far as to engage in full-scale riots, destroying Catholic neighborhoods. In Philadelphia, at one point, the militia is so outnumbered that it actually loses to the mob, even though the militia has cannons and ends up firing them outside the portals of churches. Mm. It's really quite impressive.
These are Protestant mobs in the city of brotherly love.
Quite, which was a source of some embarrassment afterwards, I must say, for the residents of Philadelphia.
Right. And talk about how, because then I think still, and let's say this, I grew up with a Southern Baptist grandfather who still did believe, mm-hmm. I think, that the Pope was the Antichrist, okay? And so this is the mm-hmm. early 20th century. I mean, we can remember some of this sentiment, although not that violence. But what did that have to do with the notion
the
of separation of church and state, and how that became more inculcated into American society?
Right. Yeah. The nativists, the anti-Catholic Protestants, often turned to the phrase separation of church and state because for them, it captured their vision of religious liberty, namely a freedom not only from government, but perhaps also from the church, from this ecclesiastical organization, which they saw as a threat to liberty.
The Catholic Church?
Yes, the Catholic Church.
But so they didn't see their ecclesiastical structures as threatening?
No, and that's one of the curious parts of the story, isn't it? Many Protestants assumed that they acted as individuals, whereas the Catholic Church acted as a church. And so if a school, for example, inculcated Protestantism and had Protestant ministers as teachers, it nonetheless did not have to be separated from government. It indeed could and should receive government funds from their point of view because there might be many Protestant denominations who participated in the organization. And in that sense, it didn't belong to any particular church. And what's more, Protestants, they assumed, responded to the individual conscience. Whereas Catholics, they thought, were subservient to the Pope. And in that sense, had to have acted as part of a church, which therefore had to be separated from government, which of course meant that Catholics had to be separated from getting jobs as teachers in public schools, that Catholics ought not vote in elections, that Catholics really should be separated from public life altogether.
And the result of this principle that they had would be that, in fact, Catholics were excluded, but Protestants would be fully integrated.
Included.
And their Protestant religious sensibility would not be too limited or...
Quite. Separation in this sense is very much the point of view of a majority, which is quite comfortable with its power, because it was a means of excluding Catholic minority, but in no way standing... but in no way creating an obstacle for Protestants who fully enjoyed public funding for their religion and indeed controlled a fair amount of legislation. So, of course, it was very appealing to the Protestant majority.
Now here's a statement that you cite in your book, Separation of Church and State, of a prominent mm-hmm. Presbyterian in 1827. And I must say, this has some echoes to today. By sheer numbers rather than law, we are a Christian nation. We have the right to demand that all our rulers in their conduct shall conform to Christian morality, and if they do not, it is the duty and privilege of Christian freemen to make a new and better election. I mean, those two things are pretty mixed up.
Yes, and that's actually an interesting quotation because in some senses, at least in a very literal sense, there's some truth to it. One certainly has a right to demand such things. That's what the first, or at least part of the First Amendment, is all about.
Yeah.
Now, whether it's a very generous way of engaging in politics is unclear because it really depends upon the tenor in which it's said. Something like that can be said in a way that is merely an expression of one's own religious point of view without wishing in any way to make any other religious group feel excluded. On the other hand, said in a slightly different tenor, that sort of thing, of course, can have other implications.
Yeah.
But that one has a right to make such demands, certainly true. Whether it's prudent or thoughtful, it depends very much on how it's said and what it's alluding to, doesn't it?
Yeah, and just the opening clause, by sheer numbers rather than law, we are a Christian nation.
Mm-hmm.
That was true, and in fact,
yes,
to some extent, it is still true. Although
quite,
it's much less clear what that means. There are many more nominal Christians,
right,
I think, maybe than.
So it seems to me the notion of a Christian nation has always had strong appeal in this country to those who are trying to overcome religious divisions and somehow try to unite Christians, particularly Protestant Christians. But of course, it's by no means clear that, although there have been a majority of Christians, that it's been by no means clear that that means very much in a nation in which Christian denominations have been so splintered. And in fact, in the 18th century, most Christians would look askance at the idea that one is a Christian nation because, of course, well, actually, let me take that back. They wouldn't look askance at the notion of being a Christian country. On the other hand, they would be skeptical at so much emphasis on Christianity uniting everybody at a time when they were trying to differentiate each other on denominational grounds. So, for example, Baptists would indeed hope that individuals would act as Christians morally and perhaps occasionally even politically, but they hoped that that meant that they would act in accord with Baptist principles, not necessarily the views of other Christians.
Yeah.
And that sense of division is actually the source of great religious freedom in this country.
I guess there's a sound in the background.
Yes, there is.
Do you know what it is? Is
it, it's the
it
air conditioning.
Broken and it just got...
The AC guy was here earlier.
Oh, can he...
They're working on it.
Okay,
she's working on
okay.
It. There it goes. By the way, can I just say
mm-hmm,
something
mm-hmm.
just off?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry if it's a little bit awkward. I've never done an interview without so disembodied before, as it were.
Oh, you mean with the headphones on? And
well, just without getting visual signals, but
oh, okay. Well,
so I apologize. I'm not normally this awkward, but
oh, don't.
It's a little bit.
No, don't apologize. And it, you know, the amazing thing about this technology is, to the listener, it does sound like we're sitting across the table from each other. I've gotten so used to it.
I'm not speaking as clearly as I would if I were in person.
I think you're fine. Also, we have this great luxury of editing you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And we do a good job of that. Kate does that. Here's the thing. I think in that kind of statement, you can see that at one and the same time, people, Americans, a couple centuries ago or even 150 years ago, they could have very strongly promoted separation of church and state, at the same time had this absolute confidence that Christianity and faith were going to infuse people and institutions. So
quite
right,
yes, and that's the benefit of being a majority member of majority, isn't it?
Yeah.
If one enjoys a majority, one doesn't really have to worry about institutional ties or Christianity. If one's a member of minority, then it becomes a much more important salient issue, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And in this sense, Protestants had, the luxury in the 18th and 19th century that they did not really have to think about an established religion. They could actually have very much their point of view reflected in law without really having to have any formal establishment.
Yeah.
And that's why I think many were quite comfortable abandoning an establishment in
right.
many states.
Okay. However, the most shocking part of the story that you tell is the implication of the Ku Klux Klan in the solidification of the principle of separation of church and state. Did you know that before you began doing your research?
No, not at all. I didn't know much about any of this, really. And I confess, I was quite astonished. And yet, oddly enough, once one thinks about it, it makes perfectly good sense. In fact, there's nothing unusual about the Klan. It's just yet another nativist organization, which therefore advocates nativist anti-Catholic perspectives, including separation of church and state. And although it was the most prominent and is the one now known best, it is not all that different from dozens and dozens of other organizations from the 1840s up through the 1930s and 40s.
But it is shocking because of the associations that we now have with the Klan.
Yes, we now think of the Klan mostly as a racist organization, and it was that, but it also had other animosities, and in that sense, I suppose, they were more varied than is often assumed. And we often think of the Klan as an organization of persons profoundly ignorant, uneducated, and perhaps just in the South. But of course, the Klan was a fully American organization which crossed most state boundaries. There was the Roger Williams Klanton in Rhode Island, and in the Northwest, they actually win political elections. They can dominate the 1924 Democratic Convention. So this was hardly a hidden organization. Although they espoused secrecy, they were actually quite public in many regards.
Right. I mean, you note that in the yes. Sorry, my.
Two things.
Sorry,
some
I'm
thumps.
Being spoken to.
We're getting some thumps from Phillips, and we fear he might be thumping the table by accident.
Are you thumping the table?
No. But I almost turned a page. Here, this is a thump on the table.
But also,
yeah.
I wanted to ask you, this Klan thing is fascinating, but I fear that we haven't gotten the story here.
Yeah.
Could
yes.
back it up?
You're right.
So
Right.
Along those lines, if I may make a suggestion, a large part of the story perhaps is first the distinction of fears of mere fear of government and disestablishment and how that gets transformed to separation through fears of churches, that broad concept. And then the second part of the story would, I think, should be the switch from the merely nativist anti-Catholic separation to the more broadly anti-ecclesiastical separation.
I want to
two
just,
thoughts.
Okay.
Okay.
I want to know.
I don't want to press that on you.
Okay. Well, no, that sounds good. I would like to know, can you remember the first time that you stumbled across this and started to realize that this was a factor?
I actually do not recall that. It doesn't stand out particularly in my mind, although I must say the work I did on the Ku Klux Klan was fascinating. I do remember that very well. I went down to Birmingham, Alabama, and found some marvelous materials there. Some very helpful librarians led me to some good stuff, which I got to put in the book. And the more I pursue it, of course, the creepier it is. One thinks that it's merely creepy at some simply prejudiced level, but of course the Klan is a religious organization, and the way it combines Klan ritual and Christianity is really quite perverse but fascinating. And so one of the things I wanted to figure out is not merely what were the prejudices, but what did Klansmen and Klanswomen, because there were a lot of Klanswomen, think, what, for example, when they were looking at a burning cross, or what did they think when they were discriminating against Catholics? I want to try to get within their prejudices so as to understand them.
And did you feel that you got there?
Oh, yes, because the Klansmen and, again, the Klanswomen write a fair amount about what they're up to. They write poetry and songs. And, for example, when they're looking at burning crosses, far from thinking that they're being prejudiced, they think that, in fact, they're helping to illuminate the world. They say, for example, that a fiery cross is a reminder, and I quote, that Christ is the light of the world, and therefore the cross could dispel ignorance, superstition, and intolerance. And, of course, these are code words about individual freedom from ecclesiastical authority, i.e. from the Catholic Church. or just give another quotation. One Klansman says that the fiery cross, blazing in its glory, with its radiance like the Statue of Liberty, enlightens the world with liberty, both civil and religious. And they think these, of course, as they're burning crosses in Catholic neighborhoods and outside churches. It's really quite extraordinary. The neatest Klan document I came across, actually, was the ritual of a women's order, the women of the Ku Klux Klan, which were spread across much of the nation, had some at least 200,000 members. And in the second degree of their order, which was known as the degree of the Criterion Conservator, of course, with K's and Criterion Conservator, they arrange various symbols in a quadrate, which is sort of a Masonic form, and they have a Masonic-style altar in the center of the quadrate, and they place various symbols on it. One symbol is the Bible and a torch, a sword, a flag, a fiery cross is nearby. And one of the symbols is a copper penny, and that one particularly interested me. And they place it on the so-called sacred altar of the Klan. And if you want, I can just read to you the ritual from that point in the ceremony. The so-called couriers place the penny upon the altar. The music stops. The couriers step back 2 paces to their original positions. At that point, the excellent commander is the leader of this group, says, "Second courier, what is the symbol you deposited upon the altar?" And the courier number 2 says, "A copper penny." An excellent commander then asks, "Caliph, its meaning?" And the caliph responds, "Christ saith, render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And shortly thereafter, the excellent commander says, "And in this degree of Criterion Conservator, we are especially reminded of this lesson, that church and state ought to be forever kept separate." And then this is repeated again in the closing ceremony, in which the excellent commander says, "The copper penny, like the tribute money of old, stands for our determination that church and state shall forever be kept separate." And a moment or two later, then, the so-called Nighthawk extinguishes the fiery cross, and the women sing the old rugged cross. It's quite extraordinary. Well, they've taken separation of church and state and mixed it into their semi-religious rituals.
So, and you have said that there was, that among their concerns and their values, nothing perhaps was more important than separation of church and state.
Yes, which is not to say, of course, that many of them were not racists. On the other hand, many were actually less concerned with race than with religion. A prominent illustration of this would be Hugo Black, who was a leader of the Jefferson Ely Klan in Birmingham. And he was actually quite liberal on questions of race, but he on some occasions indicated that he very much appreciated the principles of the Klan. And what he meant by this, surely, was not the violence, whether anti-Catholic or anti-black, but rather principles such as its anti-ecclesiasticism and particularly its anti-Catholicism and perhaps especially separation of church and state.
I guess I need to push this point. Why did they care so much? What was in it for them, the separation of church and state?
Well, one can look at this in a somewhat cynical point of view, and then one can look at it more from a perspective of their ideals. The cynical perspective would simply be that separation of church and state is a principle with which one can exclude Catholics from various jobs in government, including jobs as teachers in public schools. And certainly when the Klan becomes powerful in Birmingham, Alabama, as in cities across the nation, they try to get rid of Catholic teachers, and they vote out Catholic officials and often will boycott Catholic businesses. However, I think that's too limited a perspective. It strikes me that most people are quite sincere and idealistic, even Klansmen and Klanswomen. And it just so happens their ideals were things like separation of church and state. Now, why does this appeal to them as an ideal? Viewing themselves as Protestants and Americans, as individuals who are uninhibited by anything but loyalty to government and to God, they feared ecclesiastical organizations as a potential threat to their own mental liberty. And from this perspective, the Catholic Church seems very much a threat to the purity of democratic life in the United States. And this gets back to the whole question of religious purity. In some senses, they're seeking a religious purity. In other ways, they're seeking a sort of political purity. If one thinks of religion as a set of unrealistic expectations about purity and transcendence,
right.
What's happened in this country, perhaps, is that the aspirations that once were focused by communal organizations on aspirations for another world have now been refocused through rather individualistic ideas on this world and on individuals. And I think some of this is evident in the way in which the intensity of feeling that once was apparent so much in religion but focused on another world becomes, over the course of American history, refocused on this world and therefore on government and on individuals. And, you know, whether it's more dangerous to have unrealistic aspirations that are focused on the next world or on this world, I confess, is not altogether clear to me.
Okay.
But there may be dangers either way of different sorts.
All right. We're moving into the present now, and I've just lost. Are you there? Okay.
Is it back?
Yeah, it's back. we need to point out, you mentioned Hugo Black, who became an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, who was a Klansman, and who, in fact, wrote the opinion for the majority in 1947 in the New Jersey case, which, as you say, finally... What was the import of that? Right. I mean, that is now our milestone.
In 1947, in the case Everson v. Board of Education, Hugo Black wrote for the court that the First Amendment created an he wrote that the First Amendment created a separation of church and state. And that was the first time that the Supreme Court had made separation of church and state the measure of its Establishment Clause jurisprudence. It had alluded to the phrase earlier, but in 1947, in Hugo Black's opinion, it becomes the standard for the Establishment Clause in the United States,
okay.
Both at the state level and the federal level.
So it's really very recently that it is this constitutional
right,
the way we understand it now.
Yes, and mm-hmm. In some ways, the history of separation of church and state illustrates how an idea that once was held by just a few Americans then becomes popular through rather intense prejudices. And being celebrated as an American ideal, many other Americans, some of whom are not necessarily prejudiced but simply want to be fully American and have American ideals, end up attaching themselves to this phrase on the assumption that it is an American constitutional right. And then justices of the Supreme Court, having been brought up in a culture in which anti-Catholicism and, above all, separationism are celebrated as American ideals, end up adopting the phrase as part of their constitutional jurisprudence. In a curious way, it's an illustration of the living Constitution, but not necessarily at its best. And it raises very awkward questions about how a court can adopt phrases as constitutional standards that are not in the Constitution without the risk that they will be imposing prejudices of a majority, in a sense rewriting minority rights in terms of majority perspectives.
Yeah. So I'd like to ask you, with the perspective that you now have on, let's say, the original impulses and the original spirit mm-hmm. of this aspect of our public life, and if, in fact, that spirit has been skewed or is hard to understand correctly, has not been passed down, really, honestly, mm-hmm. what do we get wrong in, let's say, what we choose to fight about now on this subject of separation of church and state?
Well, I suppose I would begin by suggesting that this being America, we have a right to take whatever views we wish,
yeah.
even if they have no constitutional foundation. and if we wish to call that our constitutional ideals, so be it. But by the same token, I think it's also useful to be as accurate as possible when evaluating the history of the Constitution, because I think the 18th century dissenters, when they wrote about religious liberty and when the First Amendment was written, used a language that was more accurate than that which we use today. They wrote from the perspective of preserving the rights of minorities rather than preserving some American majority principle, such as separation of church and state.
Okay.
And, sorry.
Yeah, I'm just...
And what I hope my work would suggest is not that there's necessarily any one way to understand the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, but perhaps we should be more open to understanding the history on the basis of the evidence, and not simply throw around broad phrases such as separation of church and state without thinking about where they came from, why they've had so much appeal, and what their implications are for religious liberty. Because, of course, the very principles that sometimes appeal to majority may, in fact, end up discriminating profoundly against religious groups or against religion in general. So I think a little less passion and a little bit more care would improve the debate on religious liberty in this country.
I mean, I think that in our popular imagination, we think that it is perhaps non-religious people or maybe secular impulses that work to preserve this principle. And, you know, we think of the ACLU, which you do not mention in your book once, I don't believe.
I do mention it once.
Okay, once.
But just once.
Okay. So tell me, why do you only mention it once? And
actually, I think I mentioned it a few times. Mm-hmm. I don't want to deny
them
credit.
Okay.
Oh, really?
No.
I didn't write the index,
okay.
But thank you.
Mm-hmm.
My story really only goes up to 1947 and 48.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that. Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. Let me start again. Then.
Yeah.
I'll give you something else. The story that I want to tell is how separation of church and state becomes a constitutional principle in this country. And that story is not merely a story about atheism or about the ACLU, about secular demands for separation of church and state. In fact, separation of church and state becomes a popular constitutional ideal through the efforts of Protestants seeking separation against the Catholic Church. And it's only relatively late in the day that atheists, or often they call themselves secularists, become advocates of separation of church and state, primarily in the 1870s. But of course, at that period, their vision of separation and indeed their politics do not appeal to a majority in this country. And so it's only really been in the 20th century, especially since the mid-20th century, that the secularist perspective actually has the political clout that we now perceive it to have.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, that was awkward. But
No, it's not awkward. Don't worry. This is great.
Please edit.
We will edit. But it's a conversation. It's not an interview.
Okay.
And you don't have to have the right
Fair
answers
enough.
At all.
I don't.
No. And you do. You have lots of great answers. But, you also note the danger. Let's say in our time, there is something of a backlash against the separation of church and state, the way it's been imposed among religious people. Perhaps the same kinds of people who had been fighting for it a couple hundred years ago, and they experience it in some ways to diminish their religious liberty. And you do
Quite.
Also acknowledge that that is a danger of interpreting this too narrowly.
Yeah, I think many Protestants, when seeking separation from church and state, didn't fully anticipate what would happen. They thought that they were going to get a Protestant nativist separation of church and state, a separation of church and state that would separate the Catholic Church, but not Protestants, from government. And what they didn't realize was that, in fact, that they would end up getting a slightly different separation of church and state, the separation of church and state sought by secularists, by atheists, a separation of church and state that was in some sense more ecumenical. It was not merely anti-Catholic, but anti-ecclesiastical.
Mm-hmm.
And that then ended up excluding not only Catholics, but also Protestants. And so after 1948, and especially after the early 1960s, many Protestants who had previously supported separation of church and state begin to reconsider their position and realize that perhaps they hadn't thought this through as carefully as perhaps they should have.
Well, they couldn't have understood how our culture would change.
Yeah, perhaps they should have, though. it's the enthusiasms which led them to adopt a principle not in the Constitution should in itself have been enough of a warning that perhaps this was a mistake. Unfortunately, the First Amendment, and especially when put in terms of separation of church and state, elicits all sorts of passions in one direction or another. And in fact, it's quite important for the religious liberty of Americans that we, in fact, look at these matters in a dispassionate way, carefully considering the implications of every move that we make. And in that sense, I think the history can be profoundly important because it forces us to notice that our own ideas, undoubtedly based on our own assumptions, experiences, perhaps even prejudices, are not the only possible point of view, and that very respectable people, indeed the dissenters who gave us our religious liberty in the 1780s, held a rather different position. And that's not to say necessarily one has to adopt their position, but one might have to take it more seriously than we have thus far.
Do you, with the perspective you now have, and really as a historian, not as a Protestant agitator, but do you also experience...
Just off the record, I'm neither.
You're neither. Okay. Well, what do you call yourself? You're not a historian, are you? You're at the law school, right?
I'm a lawyer, but I also do history of law.
History
I do
of
both law
okay.
and history. I don't want to be put in any box, actually.
All right.
Religious,
okay.
Legal,
well, this is history. Well, let's say, just say, with the perspective you now have on the basis of this research, do you believe that there has been a loss, let's say, to our public life, or that problems are posed with the way this principle has come down and evolved and is now imposed? And specifically in terms of the contribution of religious ideas and religious people in our public life?
Well, there are a number of problems the principle of separation of church and state creates. And even though the Supreme Court, or at least some justices of the Supreme Court, have backed away from the idea, others still adhere to it, and many Americans assume that it is our constitutional freedom. And this leads in a number of different directions. First, it leads to some discomfort amongst religious individuals and organizations about participating in public life as religious individuals, because, of course, they're afraid that they'll be accused of violating the separation of church and state. And in fact, many religious individuals believing separation is the constitutional principle are afraid lest by participating as Christians in public life, they will end up violating their own sense of what the Constitution requires.
Right.
It leads to an odd chilling effect, an odd sort of self-censorship, and sometimes, of course, a fair amount of public opprobrium from various groups that advocate separation and will denounce political candidates for bringing their religion into their speeches. I think Senator Lieberman experienced some of this criticism during the last election. Now, whether one ought to bring one's religion into public discussion is an altogether different issue, but that one has a right to do so surely is the case.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, it seems to me that it also affects the actions of government, because, of course, government distributes a fair amount of money, for example, in vouchers, but also in a host of other programs to groups, some of which have more or less religious points of view. And separation of church and state is a principle that would require the government essentially to discriminate against religious groups, and what's more, to inquire into the religion of recipients, which is, of course, precisely the sort of discrimination and entanglement that many advocates of separation of church and state say that they do not want.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, the principle of separation of church and state has profound effects both on individuals who are religious and groups that are religious and the way that they participate in public life, and, of course, on the government and the way it interacts with citizens who, in effect, might be deprived of their rights under law simply an account of their religious beliefs, which is in fact the last thing that Jefferson, at least when writing in the 18th century, had wanted.
It does get so tortured also when, let's say, with the Bush administration is talking about federal funding for what are called faith-based programs and initiatives. It's the conversation becomes so quickly emotional.
Quite. And undoubtedly, politicians on both sides of the issue seek to take advantage of all the emotions. The faith-based initiatives program, I do not know about in detail, but it is interesting that it's the same program, essentially, that had existed under the Clinton administration and now is simply called the faith-based initiatives. Yeah. And in some sense, the label is designed to appeal to religious Americans, but the program itself distributes money in a purely secular fashion. And in that sense, perhaps it's the label and the legal facts of the matter go off in slightly different directions.
Your book traces a real pretty dramatic development and evolution. How do you see this interpretation and application of separation of church and state continuing to evolve in our time?
If I had a crystal ball, I would tell you. I can tell you what I hope will happen.
Okay.
I very much hope that the Supreme Court will not merely stop alluding to separation of church and state, but will forthrightly and expressly reject the principle. And I say that not because I have very strong ideas as to exactly where they should go from here, but rather because it seems to me that that principle is no longer helpful, never was helpful in understanding the complexities of our Establishment Clause. In fact, the Supreme Court has ended up legitimizing a phrase that was adopted through prejudice, that works a fair amount of discrimination, and that does not in any practical way help us resolve the issues of the Establishment Clause.
Discrimination against religious voices or?
Discrimination initially against Catholics, but then more broadly against any distinct religion. Separation of church and state stands as an obstacle to the enjoyment of normal civil rights by religious groups if, under the principle of separation, they are discouraged from exercising their full freedom of speech. What's more, if separation of church and state is understood as the American constitutional liberty, it seems to delegitimize the right of groups to receive money under secular programs for secular reasons if they happen to be religious groups. And whether the Constitution requires the government to discriminate on the basis of the thoughts wandering through someone's head seems to me rather odd.
We get there's a lot of publicity when something comes down like the ruling on the words under God, right? Or
yes.
There's a lot of publicity around some civic government banning a creche or putting a creche on the front steps of the city hall. But we can talk about that if you want to. I was speaking recently with a lawyer who said that in fact that there is a broader direction of the courts these days, which is sort of very gradually reestablishing religion, church, or, well, now it's a multiplicity of religious institutions and voices as one competing sphere among others. Do you believe that is that something you also observe?
Well, it strikes me that, in fact, religious liberty in this country has always been shaped by the essential diversity of Americans. We were less diverse in the 18th century than we are now. On the other hand, even Protestant Americans in the 18th century viewed themselves as profoundly diverse because there were so many different denominations. And that has, I think, always left us with a rather fractured sense of our religious identity in this country. As Americans, we are necessarily very different from one another in our beliefs. And it's difficult, therefore, to generalize about a religious perspective in this country. I suspect that the more religious individuals are, the more apt they will be to value their religious differences and therefore be reluctant to view themselves as part of a religious group that's somehow merely distinct from, let's say, various secular interests.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, the divisions amongst religions may seem all the more important to them. And it seems to me actually rather dangerous for religious liberty to lump religion together and treat it as an interest of some unified, homogenized sort. That's very much a non-religious view of religion. Most religious individuals, I think, are quite aware of the differences.
So what are you saying? Where does that take us?
I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well,
sorry.
All right. And I wanted to ask you how this principle is pushed by the fact that, for example, some of the religious groups that we're at least more aware of and I believe are growing also, let's say Muslims in this country, mm-hmm. don't use that term specialization that I think was something mm-hmm. that Jefferson thought about. I mean, sort of American Christians have been quite happy to put their lives into different compartments. Other people of different religious sensibility aren't so comfortable with that. And how do you see that changing or challenging the way this has evolved?
I can't help thinking that there's always a tension between the specialization and the need to have a unified life. Many of those who suggest that religion can somehow be a specialized part of their lives may not succeed as much as they think that they can. And vice versa, it seems to me many who want religion fully integrated in their lives at the same time end up specializing in areas which they don't think of as immediately religious.
Mm-hmm.
I do not think that a Christian, a Muslim, or a Jewish engineer or doctor will view their professional specialties as different on the basis of their religion, although they may bring a religious commitment to the practice of medicine or engineering. And this is a point actually that Roger Williams makes already in the mid-17th century, that necessarily there is specialization in life, but also necessarily we don't want a divided life. We live lives as individuals, as whole beings, and it's artificial to segregate these different aspects of our lives into different boxes, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So whether or not there's going to be a trend towards ever greater specialization, I don't know. I suspect that to the degree we do tend towards specialization, we then experience reactions against it. It strikes me that the presence of Muslims in this country and increasing awareness of it, because, of course, it's hardly anything new, but the increasing awareness of Muslims in this country is a reminder that religious liberty ought not be altered on the basis of the persons to whom it's applied. It's the same religious liberty for everybody, regardless of their religious affiliation. And that's one of the reasons why I'm suspicious of separation of church and state, which is an ideal adopted in antagonism against a set of newcomers. And by the same token, I'm not sure that we should alter our religious liberty simply because we are aware of a new set of newcomers. It's the same religious liberty for everybody.
I sense in the work I do that there
Excuse
is...
Excuse me, I have to turn over the studio in about 2 minutes.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Because we had an hour block, I presume.
Right, but we did start late as a result of some technical...
Right, and we're 5 minutes over right now.
Shoot,
I think we're very close to an hour. When did we start?
No, we are close to an hour.
There
I just would like to.
Technical problems on their end. We need another, like...
Can we have 5 minutes?
We need another 5 minutes.
Can we take 5 minutes off you because we had to start late?
Well, it was on both ends, the technical
problems.
Well,
except that they changed.
Uh-huh. Can we have 5 minutes?
Hello?
There's another interview waiting to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I asked him for 2 minutes. He said that we could have. Let's just go ahead. This will waste the time.
Okay.
I'll try and stretch it.
Okay. I don't know where we were. Okay. Well, let me just ask you this: How do you? You know, there has been in Americans' reactions in the process of becoming aware of Muslims in our midst and Muslims in the world since 9/11, there's one of the reactions has been, if only they got separation of church and state like we get separation of church and state.
Right.
How do you respond to that?
Yes. Well, I wouldn't want to share with them one of the worst features of American constitutional jurisprudence. I would have thought we'd want to share with them one of the best, which is disestablishment. And so, yes, religious liberty is a principle that I hope peoples across the globe can enjoy and appreciate. However, the religious liberty that is genuinely in the Establishment Clause, a freedom from the government establishment of religion rather than a separation of church and state, is what I hope we can see not only in America, but perhaps elsewhere too.
Okay, but
although I might add to that, that we sometimes elevate our own notions, even our best notions, too highly. Remember that a country such as England has a fully established church and yet also profound religious liberty.
Practicing Christians.
Oh, that's a little harsh, isn't
it? Sorry. Well, few. They have a few.
But not necessarily all of the bishops, yes. And so it seems to me that we can universalize our ideals too much. What fundamentally is important is a sense of tolerance. And that can manifest itself in many different institutional arrangements. I happen to like, as many Americans do, our own constitutional arrangements, the disestablishment and the First Amendment. On the other hand, what's of prime importance is not any particular setup through law, but rather the tolerance that gives rise to an acceptance of others, even if they disagree profoundly.
Okay, but I have to ask you finally, you make the sweeping statement that we should get rid of separation of church and state. You're not saying that we don't get rid of disestablishment. How would, very concretely, how would the expression of religious liberty in our society look different if the courts followed your suggestion?
Well, the courts already are backing away from separation of church and state. And in that sense, what I'm proposing is simply that the courts quite formally and forthrightly say what they're doing, which is no longer adhering to a separation of church and state, because that is not our constitutional principle.
Well, how would religion be in a different relationship with our civic life or with government?
Well, what would be different most profoundly is that we would not have a constitutional requirement that government place itself in an antagonistic position toward religion and particularly religious groups. The separation of church and state, if taken seriously, and the court, of course, has never really adopted a full separation of church and state. They merely said they've tried to do that. But that's not even true either, sorry. An abandonment of separation of church and state would simply make clear that religious individuals have a right to participate in politics as religious individuals or as religious groups, and whether or not that's prudent would be up to them, not a matter of constitutional law.
Okay.
And by the same token, it would make clear that government can legislate with respect to individuals on secular grounds and would not be obliged to inquire into their religious beliefs, to withhold government benefits.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'm afraid we have to finish, and I wish we had a few more minutes.
Yes.
But thank you so much for making the time
thank
to
you.
Do this.
Can I give you a call later today?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
Do you want my number now?
Call Kate's number.
Call Kate's number. She'll send you on to me.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. Thank you.